Two friends were talking after a church service, and one said, "I'm disappointed in this pastor. I didn't like that sermon at all. It just didn't make me feel good." And her companion responded, "I didn't think Jesus came to make us feel good." Many people who came into contact with Jesus must have felt good. The sick people he healed, the hungry ones he fed, the outcasts whom Jesus welcomed to his table. But our gospel tells us that the people of Jesus' hometown of Nazareth, the ones he grew up with, were not happy when they heard him speak for the first time. At first they were all smiles, and then something changed their minds. And they were outraged to the point of wanting not just to run Jesus out of town, but to throw him off a cliff. How did things go downhill so fast? Jesus had been quoting from the prophet Isaiah about a vision in which God's anointed one would release the captives and free those who were oppressed. He then told the home folks that the vision was fulfilled that day, implying that he was the one who would carry it out. What was the problem with that? The reaction of the people of Nazareth to Jesus went sour, it seems to me, for two reasons. One was their skepticism about Jesus himself, and the other was their attitude about who should benefit from God's promised liberation. One of them asked, "Isn't this Joseph's son?" That sounds harmless enough, but Jesus responds as if they had said more. We can't help thinking that something has been left out of the story, that Luke has not told us all of the people's reaction to Jesus. Matthew's gospel can help us out here. These gospels that we treasure were not eyewitness accounts. They were written decades later based on oral traditions, stories passed down from one generation to another by word of mouth. It's not hard to imagine that the authors of Luke and Matthew could have heard different details about the same story. Matthew's account of this incident does not include the prophecy that Jesus read, but it has an expanded version of what Jesus' hearers said to him. Where did this man get this wisdom and these deeds of power? Isn't this the carpenter's son? And isn't Mary his mother? Don't we know his brothers and sisters? And they took offense at him. And so, getting back to Luke's account, when Jesus' home folks asked, "Isn't this Joseph's son?" I prefer to translate it as, "Ain't that Joe's boy?" Implying reactions like, "Who does he think he is? Where does he get this stuff? He's just one of us. We know his folks. How does he come off preaching to us? He didn't even go to rabbi school." And in both gospel versions, Jesus responds to this attitude by saying, "No prophet is accepted in the prophet's own hometown." And besides this prejudice against Jesus as the local boy who made good, the home folks had another objection. They were disappointed when they realized that they might not be the first to benefit from the prophet's vision that Jesus quoted. The first century Jews that Jesus had grown up with were a part of a nation that had been under the control of oppressive empires for most of the last hundreds of years. Now they were under thumb of the Roman Empire, which occupied their territory and imposed heavy taxes. For centuries, the Jewish people had treasured the scriptural promise of an anointed one, often called Messiah, who would rule in the tradition of their heroic king, David. This new leader was expected to deliver them from their enemies and make Israel great again. So when Jesus' audience heard the prophecy from Isaiah, they naturally picked up on the part about the anointed one releasing the captives and freeing those who were oppressed. Hey, they must have thought, that sounds like us. We're the ones who need deliverance. And since we're God's chosen people, we must be first on the list. Trouble was, the Israelites had always had a flawed understanding of what it meant to be God's special people. Way back when God had called Abraham as the ancestor to the Jewish people, he made it clear that they were chosen not just to enjoy God's blessing, but to pass it on. God said to Abraham, "In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed." The people of Nazareth knew about being God's chosen ones, but like most Jews, they had missed the memo about how God wanted to bless all the peoples of the world. Jesus needed to set them straight. The great Southern fiction writer, Flannery O'Connor, has a story called Revelation, set in the American South about a century ago. It opens in a doctor's waiting room that is crowded with patients and relatives. The main character is Ruby Turpin, a large, loud woman who is not shy about expressing her opinions on different classes of people, with the implication that she, Ruby, is superior. In the waiting room is also a college student, Mary Grace, who is sitting reading a book. Ruby considers Mary Grace ugly because of her weight, her scowl, and her acne-marked face. As Ruby keeps making prejudiced remarks about black people and other people she considers white trash, Mary Grace gets more and more angry. Finally, she has heard enough and she throws her book, hitting Ruby just over her left eye. She also tries to choke Ruby. The medical staff subdue and sedate Mary Grace, but not before she hisses to Ruby, "Go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog." And that incident, the story says, is the beginning of Ruby's redemption, in which she takes seriously the possibility that she might not be the ideal Christian woman that she presented as. And the story closes with Ruby's vision of a parade of people into heaven, where the black people and the white trash and the lunatics march into heaven ahead of Ruby and her class of people. O'Connor commented that often revelation begins when a book hits you squarely on the head. And that's what Jesus does in a less literal way to the people of his hometown. He throws a book at them, or rather books from their own scriptures. Books we know as 1 and 2 Kings. He reminds them of two stories that many of them would already be familiar with. The first story is about Elijah, the greatest of the greatest of the Hebrew prophets, who served during a severe drought resulting in famine all across Israel. God sent Elijah to a widow in a place called Zarephath, and as a result of his ministry, the woman and her son were able to eat for the rest of the food shortage. The other story was about Elijah's successor, the prophet Elisha, through whom God healed from leprosy a man named Naaman, an army commander in the nation of Syria. Jesus reminds his home folks that both the widow and the army commander were Gentiles, regarded as foreigners by the Israelite people, and that God's mercy reached out to these Gentiles even though there were many needy people in Israel. And by this time, his hearers were so mad at Jesus, they wanted to get rid of him. They could not accept that those people were just as deserving of God's blessing as we are. Sometimes you hear this perspective expressed today as an argument against immigration. Why don't we take care of Americans who are already here before we let those immigrants in? But in God's economy, there is no place for an us and them attitude. That's especially important to remember now that our national government is being run by people who are committed to making discrimination great again, who want to take away some individual's rights, and who want to banish people who they don't think deserve to live among us. Last Sunday, Pastor Barb mentioned Bishop Marion Buddy, who publicly urged the newly inaugurated president to show mercy to those who are scared. Most of us are not in a position to speak directly truth to power at the highest levels, but we all can do something. We can contact our leaders. Just this week, the administration backed down on a widespread and scary spending freeze, apparently because enough people made noise about it. We can support organizations that work for justice and provision for all. We can provide a listening ear to people who are scared of what's happening. And we can make a special effort to be gracious and friendly to people that others have rejected. And we can pray for our leaders. Even though that they don't see things our way, or may not, we still should pray for them. And as we do, we can remember God's promise in Paul's letter to the Romans that in all situations, God works for the good of his people. Trusting God's promise can help us maintain our sanity in this troubled time. And when we stand up for rights for everyone, inclusion for everyone, food for everyone, housing for everyone, justice for all, not just for certain groups, we are dancing to the beat of God's heart. Amen.